Hello there, I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news, with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts, as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Zone Media.
Welcome back yet again to Behind the Bastards, a podcast about G. Gordon Liddy. you know, we initially did four parts, and I was like, that's probably about as much G. Gordon Liddy. I had hoped to cover his whole life in four parts, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop getting into these little rabbit holes. Kept getting pulled into things. He's just too interesting. And I'm always, you know, whenever we have an episode that runs into the multi-parts, I get kind of anxious because I'm afraid that, like, you know, no episode is everybody's favorite, right? And so we try to have variety. We try to go back and forth between, you know, we got cult leaders, business monsters, Nazis, you know, quack doctors, all that sort of stuff. So everybody gets some of what they like. So I get worried whenever we start going too long on one guy. But I listened to the first four episodes, and I kept feeling like we were doing a disservice to the audience by not finishing the G. Gordon Liddy story. You know,
I will admit it did feel like there was like plenty more to do.
There's so much more.
I think to your point. You know, it does. He does cover. He's like a real like multi-hyphenate in terms of true fuck faces of the 20th century.
And we're missing still. You know, Watergate is quite a thing, and his fascinating brain is worth studying. But we're missing a whole chunk of his career, which is where he kind of invents the modern concept of a right-wing influencer in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, welcome back to the show.
What up?
Now, folks, you may have noticed the absence of a certain voice in the audience today. Sophie is not here. She was taken into custody by Nicaraguan authorities after a brief gun battle last weekend. She's fine. We're working on getting her out. You know, it's just a misunderstanding to do with some.
It's just some paperwork
federal.
That needs to be filed.
Yeah, sure. Nothing yes, major. Paperwork. Yes, that's it. That's right. Sorry, Ian. Yes, paperwork, not kidnappings. So, Ian Johnson, our inimitable editor, is sitting in for her today. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm doing pretty good. Excited to learn more about the G-Man. You know, he's burning himself, lighting his hands on fire.
Yes.
I love it. So let's keep it coming.
You know, I'm kind of low-key glad that Sophie wound up trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government last weekend. Because this is an episode that does need a little bit of a boys club. Because we're going to not just be talking about G. Gordon Liddy, but a lot of concepts of masculinity in our society. That I think he kind of embodies pretty well. So this will be good. This will be a good time for the bro squad.
Okay, we're going to bro down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
We're going to bro down hard, everybody.
Just guys being dudes.
Just guys being fellas. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Ian, when I was trying to come up with ways to introduce this show last night, I was thinking up nicknames for you in my head since I haven't gotten to do that much.
I'd love to hear these.
Well, I was going to go with Ebow the Letter, which is a reference to an R.E.M. song about River Phoenix that that like four people know today. All of the people who listened to that song back in the 90s are dead now, except for like me and I'm going to guess Dan Aykroyd. He was one of River Phoenix's friends, and right? No,
maybe one of the guys in REM, or they don't even know it anymore.
No, no, no. There's no way Michael Stipe remembers this. Not with all of the Michael Stipe-induced brain damage he has. are we ready for The Last of Liddy?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Let's do it.
Okay, okay, okay. When we left off with the G-Man, he had just been convicted and sentenced to like 20 years in prison for his many crimes, many incompetent crimes. Now, obviously, Liddy does not do close to 20 years in prison, but he and his family don't know that where he goes inside. And for everything I can tell, I believe he was fully willing to serve that amount of time, right? One thing you can't take away from the guy is his commitment to the bit. And the bit, of course, is fascism. So I don't really respect it, but I do respect the commitment, you know?
Yeah.
You just kind of have to past a certain point.
Look, I'm worried that I have repeated this analogy before on this very show, mm-hmm. but it's a little bit the same as like the 9/11 hijackers. Mm-hmm. Everyone constantly calls those attacks cowardly.
Absolutely not.
And the one thing they absolutely were not is cowardly.
Look, it wasn't a good thing to do, but it was not cowardly.
Yeah, it was very brave.
Yeah, well, I think this goes into actually something that's very relevant to these episodes, which is that our culture places a moral value on concepts like courage, and courage, physical courage, is an absolutely amoral value. The SS, a lot of guys with physical courage in the SS, doesn't matter, doesn't make them good, is not like a redeeming trait. It's the same thing. You know, when I say something is respectable, respect does not imply morality. It's like if somebody is incredibly good at breaking and entering into houses in order to like take people's valuables, that may not be a good thing. He's probably hurting a lot of people, but you have to respect the degree of skill in busting through a lock, you know?
Yeah. Also, that one isn't as unambiguously bad as...
No, it's not. I don't...
We've been a breaking and entering. It's all where it goes.
A little bit of B and E. Yeah, I guess it depends on the B and the E.
Yeah.
So, back to Liddy. So he goes inside, and his wife takes a job. I think she's a sixth grade teacher, and is completely the one taking care of the family while he is out. She has some help from Gordon's parents, but his father, Sylvester, is going to die about halfway through his time in prison, which I think seriously reduces the ability of the in-laws to kind of take care of them. This also means that Liddy is going to be left without the, let's say, questionable moral support that his dad was able to. That was like the one thing holding him back, though, right? I think if his dad had been alive, he probably would have given his dad a copy of the autobiography before it went published. And his dad would have been like, you got to de-Hitler this thing by about 50%.
Everyone needs that person in your life to just say, less Hitler. I know we all want a Hitler a ton.
Yeah. Count up the Hitler references in your book. Cut them in half. You know what? Cut them in half. Half as much Hitler. Fair enough.
It's so, like Coco Chanel for Coco Chanel and Coco Chanel.
Yeah, that's right. You just the Chanel. Leave the Coco out. I think the problems are in the Coco. So Liddy's lawyer during this period is a guy named Peter Maroulis. And if you comb through old New York Times articles or other contemporary Watergate coverage, you'll see Maroulis mentioned a lot. He had a reputation for being mild-mannered but persistent. He was apparently pretty good-looking. It's hard to judge his actual competence from this case because Liddy doesn't really give him a chance to be a great defense lawyer, right? Liddy is like, I am guilty and I will say nothing else, which is, to be fair to Peter, a difficult position to be in as a defense attorney. You don't have a lot of wiggle room there. It is really funny the way in which the G-Man describes his because Maroulis is his former law partner and his best friend, quote,
oh,
a tall, powerfully built man with a Clark Kent face and glasses under thinning sandy hair, Peter Maroulis will correct anyone who refers to his ethnic extraction as Greek by advising sternly that he is a Spartan. He was my best friend.
Oh, my God.
I wasn't sure we were going to get a Sparta reference in here, but there we go. There we go. Yeah. We got it. We did it, everyone.
It's good to know. And this probably goes back literally as to Herodotus. People who call themselves a Spartan are the fucking worst.
Oh, yeah. Anyone who, because, like, they weren't good at, like, their period of time as, like, it like objectively dominant in the Greek peninsula was like roughly the period of time Martin Scorsese has been making movies, right? Like it's not like that long a span of time. And I think Scorsese is more impressive as like a force in culture. But Marullus is not a Spartan, of course. He is from Poughkeepsie, which is the opposite of Sparta, I think. Probably in a good way, but whatever. When he first went away, when Liddy first goes away, gets locked up, he's sent in a local jail, kind of as his case is winding its way to completion. He gets a period where he's convicted, but he's not like permanently sentenced and everything. Hey, everyone, Robert here. I actually got this wrong. I double checked, and Sparta's period of military dominance in Greece was something like was a little over 30 years, whereas Scorsese's been directing for like 50 something years. It would have been better if I had compared the length of time that Sparta was the dominant military power in Greece to like the run of The Simpsons at present, although they'll beat it soon. And he describes himself during this early period of incarceration as totally at peace, because while he had abandoned his family and left his wife to fend for their five children completely alone, it was all in service of a greater cause. And that greater cause was Richard Nixon. Now, Liddy was not unaware of the fact this is an unfair thing to do to your wife, right? To abandon her for half a decade in order to protect Dick Nixon. the man least deserving of loyalty of anyone who has ever lived. But yeah, at one point, he seems to have been somewhat aware, dimly at least, that this was not a morally clean thing for him to be doing. And so at one point, this is what's one of the things that's interesting about him. At one point, he sits down with her on a visitation day and is like, look, I know this is not what you signed up for. This is not fair. If you want to leave me, get a divorce, find someone new, you know, that's totally fine with me. I'll sign the papers. I'll do whatever. And Fran opts to stick by him, which is, I guess, at least proof that even the sickest weirdos on this planet can find true love. I don't know what you want to like interpret from that. I don't find it optimistic, but it is a thing.
In a weird way, yeah. It's pretty sweet.
It's very
like twisted, but it's sweet. Yeah,
it's a deeply sweet thing to do. Again, I hate that this incredible gesture of love is on behalf of Richard Nixon, or at least partly so. Like, that's not great, but
yeah,
it is what it is. It is. So Gordon does not describe his experience in prison as bad. He does, however, describe it like a white guy raised on Clint Eastwood movies from the 70s, right? This is like, I don't know the degree to which I know that he's not telling the full truth. I suspect he is censoring his true feelings about his time behind bars significantly and consciously aping movies from the 1970s in this book that he writes, because he knows that that'll sell with conservatives, right? There's a lot of Dirty Harry in a number of chunks of this book. Here's one line where he talks about his early days in jail. In here, people were all neighbors, and it was like old home week. I couldn't understand most of what was being said. It was all in black dialect, and I didn't speak it. I have since, of necessity, become fluent. I don't think that's the case, because he writes, and I'm not going to read him writing what he calls black dialect, but he does attempt to at several times, and I do not find him credible. I'll say that.
Yeah, this is some real I speak jive.
It is.
Did this come up before Airplane?
I actually don't know that. I'm not exactly sure when that movie came out. It's pretty embarrassing to read. Again, I'm not going to like go too much into it because of how embarrassing it is. But you should know that this is not just a thing he does once, but a thing that is like repeatedly a part of this chunk of his narrative. So because Liddy and McCord and Hunt all got caught and charged so far ahead of the bulk of the Watergate scandal breaking out, there's this long lag time. And this is one of the things that the two different TV shows we've talked about really fuck up. I mean, I don't think they fuck it up. I think it's a narrative choice they make. But they really mess with the timeline for the purposes of making it seem like guys like John Dean and Ehrlichman and whatnot getting in trouble times up with the break-in and with guys like Hunt and Liddy getting in trouble much better than it does. In reality, the shit with Hunt and Liddy happens well ahead of the rest of the scandal breaking. And so these guys are all kind of in jail while the Nixon administration is falling apart. Liddy is determined to prevent this, to prevent Nixon from getting forced out of office. Again, the whole thing that was kind of like keeping him together was the idea that by sacrificing himself and his family, he could keep Nixon in office. That that like the chain of custody would stop with him and that Nixon wouldn't get in trouble if he went away. And he kind of comes to the conclusion that if McCord or Hunt in particular break, that's such a danger to the administration that he would have to murder them, you know? So he claims that, you know, he says that he makes, because he claims he's very popular with some of these other prison guys. And he claims that one of these dudes, and he always tells you that these are black men, tells him that the price of a murder is 2 cartons of cigarettes. He works out a plan basically where he'll assault a guard to get sent to solitary for a few days. And then this friend of his who's totally his buddy will murder whichever one of his co-conspirators that he needed dead. Knowing Liddy, knowing his general level of competence, I wouldn't be surprised if he got a dude to say, yeah, man, give me cigarettes and I'll totally murder a dude with you. Send yourself to solitary and I'll make it happen. Right. Like, I would not be surprised if someone scammed him. As a spoiler, he never comes close to hurting anyone in prison that we can prove in any way, shape, or form. I think a lot of this is just bluster and this dude having watched a lot of prison movies.
I just back of the enveloping a little bit of even with inflation, how the fuck are you going to try to get away with 2 cartons of cigarettes is the price? Like, yeah. Get the fuck out of here.
I think the idea is that, like, well, if you're a lifer or whatever, it doesn't really matter either way. You'd rather have the cigarettes or whatever. But, like, I think they're going to take your cigarettes, right? Like, if you murder a guy, they're going to throw you in solitary. I don't know. It doesn't seem that, especially since we're talking about, like, very high-profile prisoners. Like,
yeah.
It's one thing if it's like, yeah, if you murder this other dude who's a lifer and who nobody on the outside cares about, and you could probably get away with it because the prison authorities aren't going to investigate. If you murder E. Howard Hunt, like,
yeah,
they're not just going to pretend that didn't happen, you know?
But also, people know what kind of money you have access to and what you're trying to do. You don't think the price is going to be $100,000 to my family on the outside?
You don't think anyone's going to, like, FOIA to see, like, hey, this guy got murdered right after G. Gordon Liddy gets put in solitary. Did he buy anything for another prisoner right beforehand? Like, is that documented? Like, every journalist in the country would have pored over this. Anyway, whatever. But again, Liddy never does anything. Gordon claims that during the start of his time in prison, he is, because he's a white man in a jail, the subject of numerous racial epithets during the start of his time behind bars. He says his new neighbors were particularly angry because, and this is his fault, he would walk naked to and from the shower, which he thought was fine because of his experiences in high school gym. But, like, it's apparently rude in a prison. Now, again, prison mores change regularly and differ from region to region. But this seems like a pretty easy thing to know if it's, like, getting a bad reaction to people. Just don't walk naked around it. Put a towel on, man. Like, it's not that hard. Anyway, his decision is not to just put a towel on. He says that after a week or so, being called honky, he decides to fight back. And I'm going to give you one guess as to how he decides to fight back against anti-white racism. What he describes is that.
Did he light himself on fire?
No. Oh, that was the other likely. No, Ian. No, it's Nazi. It's Nazi stuff. Yeah. He does a Nazi again.
He's got one play. And he loves the play. No,
Ian's right. He's got two. He has bringing up the SS and lighting himself on fire. Like, those are the only two plays he ever developed.
Well, at that point, that was also the King Nazi move.
Yeah. Yeah. Light yourself on
yourself
fire.
On
sure.
fire. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what Hitler did to the whole country.
Yeah.
So, quote, I seethed. Then an idea. He seethed after getting, you know, yelled at.
Yeah.
Then an idea hit me. They wanted race. I'd give them race. My mind reached back 35 years, deep into my childhood. In my head, the shortwave of my mother's old Emerson snapped on. The music started, and I started to sing as I hadn't in years. I roared out into the chaos about me, the anthem of the nation, whose psychotic obsession with race sent millions of those believed inferior to their graves. And then he starts singing the Horst Wessel lied.
Oh my God.
By the
even as far as Nazi shit you could do in prison, that is impressively bonkers.
And he's like, there was something so powerful about the music that they all stopped yelling at me as soon as they heard it, even though they didn't speak German. And it's like, no, they look, I'm going to, yeah, of course, I'm going to guess most people in the DC jail did not speak German, but like, they knew this was Nazi shit. They knew, like, it's not that hard when a guy starts singing a martial German song. You get what's going on in a jail. Yeah. Like, so this is where it's pretty fun. So after some time in the DC jail, he gets sent to a larger facility, Danbury, and he's still kept out. He's in a bigger facility now, but he's kept out of the general population because he still hasn't been sentenced. He claims that during this time, he met another Nazi, the son of the SS Gestapo commander of Brussels, who became his chess partner. He's like, I met the son of this SS Gestapo commander in Brussels. And we started becoming like, chess buddies. Quote, we get on famously. He knows more songs than I do. And shower time sounds like the invasion of Poland.
Oh, my God.
That's a sentence you should not ever write. Now,
just these two naked Nazis belting out fucking Wagner in the
First off, comparing your shower time to the invasion of Poland, let me remind you all, 3 million Jewish Poles are murdered during the Nazi occupation, along with at least 1.8 million non-Jewish Polish citizens. That's a little bit political, right? Like the Polish state will say it's about 3 million Polish citizens. Honestly, that doesn't really sound impossible to me. Like a lot, so many Polish people die as a result of the occupation. More importantly, though, we can actually drill into the accuracy of this claim, his claim that he was buddies with the son of the SS Gestapo commander in Brussels, because that's a job. We know who did that gig, right? The head of this Gestapo in Belgium was a dude named Constantine Canaris. Now, you may have heard of a guy named Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. Canaris was a Nazi who was one of the guys that was kind of part of the plot against Hitler that's in that Tom Cruise movie. Mm-hmm. He gets a little rehabilitated for this. That should not be the case. Wilhelm Canaris is like not one of the worst Nazis, but was definitely a Nazi. Yeah. He worked very closely with Reinhard Heydrich, architect of the Holocaust. He's one of these dudes who doesn't like Hitler at the end because he thinks Hitler's losing the war. And he gets executed, by the way, should have been executed and was fucking executed. His nephew is Constantine Canaris, who is the head of the Gestapo in Brussels when Brussels is occupied by the Nazis. Constantine is also a fucking war criminal. He gets sentenced to 20 years hard labor for a number of things. He's responsible for the execution of a number of political prisoners. He plays a significant role in the roundup and deportation of Belgian Jews. He is one of the guys who helps do the Holocaust, right? Constantine Canaris. Obviously, he's the Gestapo head in Belgium. Yeah. He's not a good person. Constantine serves half of his sentence and then dies in 1983, which is 3 years after Liddy's book was published. I have a little trouble nailing this down entirely, but his German Wikipedia entry says that he has multiple sons, but it only names two of them. And of the sons that I know he had, neither of them ever spent any time in a U.S. prison. Klaus Wilhelm was a legal scholar and a professor who spent his entire life living and working in Germany. Volker Canaris became a director and produced a famous movie about the Commandant of Auschwitz. He also spent his life in Germany. I can find absolutely no evidence that that Constantine Canaris had a son who went to the United States and was put in a DC area jail or prison. No evidence whatsoever that this happened. I believe, based on what I can confirm, that G. Gordon Liddy is lying about this, or that some random dude lied to him about being this guy's son. You know?
Yeah.
Either could have happened.
It feels like at this point, it's, you know, hey, the guy that was singing fucking Nazi songs in the other prison before he got transferred over, I'll just tell him as a regular ass American Nazi that I'm a special Nazi.
Yeah, that I'm Constantine Canaris's son. Anyway, again, he's lying here. Or I think that like there's a pretty good chance that Liddy is lying, because he does lie regularly in his memoir. And I hope that keeps in your head as we investigate the wackier claims he makes on his journey. Anyway, moving on. Liddy says that due to his familiarity with FBI studies on interrogation, he knew that the ideal time to interrogate and break a person who has been locked up is after 6 weeks. That the FBI likes to leave people in custody for about 6 weeks, because there's this kind of initial period you get when you move into incarceration where you get like extra resilient and like kind of tough and like, I can take this, I'm gonna. And that after about 6 weeks, the kind of natural boost you get from that wears down and you're at the lowest point in your psychological defenses. So he figured that they were going to wait until he'd been in there a couple of months, and then they were going to try to break him, right, and get him to talk, because that's when he would be at his most vulnerable. So he decides that he has to build up his willpower to fight back. And the first move he takes to do this is to become, honestly, I hope, if you've got an eating disorder, we're going to talk about that a bit here. He decides to cut his food intake to 600 calories a day and starve himself while doubling his daily exercise routine. And like, he describes this as a mental exercise to increase his willpower. As someone who has had an eating disorder, this all reads to me like a guy describing his descent into anorexic mania in order to have more control over his situation after being locked up. Like,
right.
That is how this reads to me. And I'm gonna read you a segment from that. Quote, "My mood remained steady. I was getting along with all the other prisoners. Things were going very well. Too well, I decided. I needed more stress to bring my will to maximum power. I turned to my old reliable method of ordeal by fire. This test would have to exceed all others in destruction of tissue and time of severe pain. I selected a particularly strong-willed black bank robber named Tex with whom to engage in a battle of wills. Ready with a box of wooden matches, I got him into a discussion of the subject and pressed him to the point where he expressed disbelief and challenged me. Because I had been warned never again to indulge in that practice near or on finger joints, and my palm was already burned out. Jesus Christ, Gordon. Oh. I had to go back to where I started years before. My forearm. The scars there were light. Strike a match, I said to Tex, and locked my eyes onto his. He struck it and held it out, not knowing what to do next. I put the unburned outside of my left forearm directly over the flame. As the fire burned through my flesh and melted it back into a blackened depression, a look of horror came over Tex, but he stayed with it. The match burned down and scorched his fingers before he dropped it. I grinned at him as he looked at the burn unbelievingly, then looked ill, got up, and left.
So, I know this is somewhat your excerpting of this book, yeah, but it is a little telling that I feel like over about four some hours now, the only moments of human intimacy he seems to have is while he's burning himself.
Well, he's lighting himself on fire. Yes.
Yeah. It's really shocking.
This is both the kind of I'm going to starve myself to damage my body by starving myself. And I am going to engage in these kind of self, like, this is the same as cutting, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a lot of that going on here. He has to frame it as this, like, this is willpower.
I mean, or, it's like, in as clearly this is a very, like, mm-hmm, this autobiography is unedited, essentially. This is clearly what he's telling himself. So, like,
this is what he has to believe about it, right? But, like, this is also something he pretty consistently goes back to in times of, like, stress and anxiety. Speaking of self-harm, you know what's...
And human intimacy.
You know what's fundamentally... Well, I don't know. Self-harm is much more complicated than that. But what's not complicated is these ads. Robert Evans here, and as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Ho, 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 we're back. We're back and we're talking about G. Gordon Liddy, who, you know, I will say this. I bet one of the things that will stop people from fucking with you in jail is lighting yourself on fire while staring at them. That does seem like an effective way to make someone be like, this guy's not worth it. Like,
that is the weird thing is it's like he has this desire to cultivate this, like, I survived prison tough guy shit. And the shit that he's actually doing, he just like, it's so weird what he chooses to frame in which way. Yeah. Cause he could just be like, this was how I chose to.
If he had written like, I wanted to scare people. So I lit I permanently damaged my skin without breaking eye contact because I thought that, and like, I would believe that. I would be like, yeah, man, that does sound like something. Does sound like people would probably give you a little bit of space. Liddy also tells several stories of fights that he got in, and I don't really believe. I will say I believe he got in some fights because most people who spend years in prison wind up having an altercation or two at very least, right?
Yeah.
These are never particularly glorious stories. He tries to punch them up. Like, there's one where somebody steals something, and so he has to go and like fight that guy so that other people won't mess with him. And he describes it as like a fair fight, but he gets cut up horribly because this dude has a fighting ring, which is a cheap ring with the stone removed that will cut an opponent if you punch them with it. And so he goes into loving detail about how he like talks his way into buying a fighting ring. He spends like a meaningful amount of time telling us about how he gets this fighting ring for himself, but he never uses it. Like, he talks a lot about all the weapons he acquires in prison, and he doesn't ever do anything with them. He just he needs you to know he has them.
Knife catalog guy.
Very, very strong knife catalog guy energy.
Yeah.
This dude has a knife shaped like an eagle with an American flag printed on the blade. Absolutely. Yeah. So while his skill at letting himself be severely burned for no reason convinced Liddy that his will was inviolate, E. Howard Hunt is not doing so well, right? Hunt is notably less satisfied spending the rest of his life behind bars. He's got several kids and, you know, Hunt, you'll know this at least if you watched the White House Plumber show. His wife dies in a mysterious plane crash, like while she's taking money in between a number of these Watergate convicted guys. It's very shady. You know, Hunt kind of made some statements about having knowledge of the JFK thing. It's all a messy story. Hunt's also a famous liar and fabulous, so I don't know how much you want to read into that. But he is in a bad position here, right? And he starts to unravel pretty soon after they all go behind bars. Now, Gordon becomes convinced that Hunt's betrayal would destroy his beloved Nixon. So he starts preparing to carry out an assassination against his old friend. Because Liddy is starving and deranged by this point, he starts looking for hidden messages in his limited communications with the Nixon people and mostly in newspaper articles. He's sure that the Nixon campaign is going to send him a message to kill E. Howard Hunt via, like, statements made to the papers and shit.
Yeah. So
he sits down with his friend, this gangland figure, who told him that you can kill a guy with the price of two cartons of cigarettes. And he tells the dude, Nixon hasn't told me through, like, the fucking Washington Post to murder E. Howard Hunt yet, but it's surely coming.
Quote, yeah, let's get it on the schedule.
Yeah, let's get it on the schedule. Quote, that precaution out of the way, we decided quickly upon the method. Hunt received special meals because of his history of ulcers. In the parlance of the D.C. jail, it was a diet tray. It was served to him in his cell rather than in the CB4 mess hall on the first floor. Should I be ordered to kill Hunt, he would be served a special meal indeed. It would contain a lethal poison. I believe this is, it's like nicotine, right? They're going to like, because you can, if you have cigarettes, you could like basically concentrate the nicotine oil, and pure nicotine is pretty easy to kill someone with. That's his plan. Again, I don't actually know that he knew anybody who had the capacity to do that.
Yeah.
This is more bluster for the book. The reality is that Hunt told Liddy, like, what actually happens. He talks a lot about how ready he was to kill this guy, all the plans he had. What really happens is Hunt tells Liddy, hey man, fuck Nixon. I'm gonna rat, you know? I'm gonna rat for a better deal. And Liddy pouts and refuses to ever talk to him again, but he doesn't do anything else. Nothing happens. Like, again, all hat, no fucking cattle is the way to summarize this guy's whole life. The most important thing to know about Liddy's time behind bars is that it served as a surrogate combat experience for him. That's why he's so dedicated to this, right? He never gets to go to Korea. He never gets to fight anybody. He never gets to kill anybody, but he has this public chance where all he has to do is sit and be quiet. and he will build the reputation he's always wanted as a hard, dangerous, tough man, right? It's quite easy. His wife has to go through hell, right? His kids have to go through hell. All he has to do is sit quietly in a room for several years. And then he gets this thing that means more than anything to him. Proof that he's a hero, right? That's all he has to do. So this is really, in a lot of ways, the fact that he gets caught and charged for Watergate is the best thing that ever happens to him, right?
Yeah.
Like, this really is what gives him what he wants.
A psychological twist in that, yeah. Like, yeah, this is definitely the best shit that's ever happened to him.
Do you guys ever, any of you guys ever listen to the band Dawes?
Nope.
Not familiar.
Yeah, it's a, I don't know, kind of a folk bluegrassy outfit. They got a song called When My Time Comes that I think there's a line in it that really well sums up kind of the young male attitude about bravery, the attitude about like courage and heroism that you have as a kid, like as a dumb kid, that I think leads a lot of people to like, you know, joining the military and stuff like that. It inspires a lot of actually some of our worst behavior. There were moments of dreams I was offered to save. I lived less like a workhorse, more like a slave. I thought that one quick moment that was noble or brave would be worth the most of my life. This thing that like, and what's going on, what they're talking about here is this like, this realization you get as an adult, how complicated and difficult and messy and gray the world is, and how nice it is to feel like you can do just one thing.
Yeah.
If it's the right thing at the right time, and then you've succeeded at being a person, right? Like, even if you die doing it, at least you don't have to think anymore. Like, and the reality is that like doing good is hard and complicated. And like what his wife does, what Liddy's wife does is by every measure much more impressive, right?
Yeah.
Like it's not fancy. It doesn't get you a career as a media influencer, but like committing to care for children for 4.5 years alone, 5 kids, is so much braver than sitting in a cell alone, right?
Like, well, I think it's like the need a shortcut, silver bullet, like shoot the moon of having a worthwhile life. Like these fucking clouds, or not even clouds, lots of people feel despair. And it's just like, well, this thing will make me a person. Mm-hmm. This will do it. Just get the lottery. Just get the right, like, meaning of life lottery ticket.
Yeah, 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 that's it. And he's gotten his lottery ticket. So that's, I do believe to an extent that he's got morale behind him in this because he's getting everything he wants from it. So I do suspect that eventually, though, like with anyone, like just being locked up, being behind bars, being in this situation, he does start to grow deranged. And some of this is probably because he's starving himself, which is not great for your mental health. And Liddy doesn't have the self-awareness to recognize this, but you see pieces of it in stories he tells. Probably the best one that best embodies this is he tells one story of a time when he's out, he's jogging in the yard. They've got rec time, so they're kind of outside. He's doing laps. And he sees a dead rat on the ground, right? This huge, nasty, decomposing dead rat. And he becomes instantly convinced that there's another prisoner who's like kind of sitting nearby and that this guy picked up the rat from somewhere else and put it down where Liddy would see it to fuck with him, which is insane. Like, it is a prison. There's rats. Rats die. There's no reason for him to think that another prisoner stuck the rat there. And also, it's like, so he just placed the rat kind of vaguely near a chunk of the running path that you might pass. Like, that doesn't seem likely, G. Gordon Liddy. That doesn't like, really seem like a taunt, even.
What from, like, putting yourself in their shoes, like, what the fuck was the plan, dog? Yeah.
So he gets so angry at this that he steps on the rotting rat to squish it and like mash it up. And he picks up this like rancid, decomposing, fetid carcass. And he walks over to the guy with it. And he's like, here's your rat. And the guy's like, what the fuck? I'm just trying to get some, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, the guard did it, you're saying. And the guy is again like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, man. Like, it is, again, even from Liddy's prose, it's very clear that everyone else is like, oh, this guy's fucking lost it.
Yeah. And telling this story after the fact is what? I mean,
That's something you keep to yourself, I think.
That's something you never tell anybody. Yeah. Maybe if you're like having an emotional conversation with your loved ones afterwards to tell them how bad it got. Anyway, whatever. Liddy is also peculiar in his time behind bars because he is not just an unrepentant fascist. He's also a lawyer. And he does care to an extent about the letter of the law. Even though he's always, even behind bars, a strong supporter of mass incarceration, he's livid every time his fellow inmates have their rights abused because he knows what the jails and prisons are supposed to provide, and he knows when they're falling short, and he can't stand for it. And so he becomes a jailhouse lawyer for everyone inside. And from everything I've read, he really does quite a lot. He helps a number of these guys. This is probably more than anything why he doesn't get fucked with much, because like he really does provide a service after a while to a lot of dudes. You know, he helps them work through their cases. He gives them advice on how to appear in court. He helps them file motions and stuff to get things that they need. He makes complaints like on behalf of this, there's this Jewish prisoner who's not getting kosher meals. He like forces the prison to give this guy kosher meals. He develops feuds with a couple of different prison officials. He's in like 8 different facilities. And I think his reasons are genuine. Some of these prisons, like people get killed doing dangerous work, and he's angry about that. The food is not of sufficient quality. Stuff like faucets and shit in prison facilities aren't being maintained. And he understands who to send letters to, what kind of letters to send, who to threaten in order to force the system to take action. And I think he's actually quite good at this. And it's evidence that, like, again, had he been a better person, a guy like Liddy with these skills could have helped a lot of people in his life. You know?
It's like so close, and it's so telling that his own autobiography doesn't see what could be good about him and what could be redeeming about him.
I think he
so
sees,
weird.
Yeah, he sees this as good because it's bad for the system not to be consistent. And he sees this as good because these people deserve anything.
Right.
But, you know, maybe I'm being too negative. Probably the height of this behavior is when Gordon and more than 500 fellow inmates, he basically helps forces like a hunger strike at a facility he's at. He gets 500 fellow inmates to refuse to eat food for several days. It's the longest of 3 strikes at that facility that year, and Liddy's leadership seems to be why. The prison officials are so frustrated with him that he gets transferred to a maximum security facility afterwards. This is like when he's at a minimum security place. He does spend a period of his bid behind bars in California because, you remember, he broke into that psychiatrist's office, Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. So at a point in time, he gets like sent over to California because you got to do some time there because some of your crimes are over there. He claims that by this point, he was famous in the prison system and he gets gifted with treats by his new neighbors when he arrives. I don't disbelieve that necessarily. Number one, he's probably got a good reputation. He helps people. He's also famous. So like, you know,
just straight up.
Straight up. Like fame gets you places, right? But then he goes into what is definitely a lie. He tells an elaborate story about how one of the fellow inmates in California is a kung fu master who just happened to be locked up too. And this guy is from like, you know, this guy is from China. He's like traveled to the US under mysterious circumstances, but then he gets locked up and like we become friends. And Liddy writes one of the most embarrassing paragraphs I've ever read in my life. We worked out at the weights together, and finally I decided it might be mutually advantageous to exchange instruction. He hesitated, then took me aside and told me that he had never imparted such knowledge to an Occidental, and despite our friendship, was not sure he ever should. He paused and studied me quietly. Finally, he spoke. You are a very violent man. I can see it in your eyes. I control it. Liddy said, you must, if you ever use what I teach you to take advantage of the weak, I'll find you wherever you are and kill you myself. Of all the things that have never happened, this is the thing that's least happened in the history of things that didn't happen.
Oh my God. It's like a cut scene from Mortal Kombat.
Embarrassing. That is embarrassing, G. Gordon Liddy. Under no way did any of this. Now, it's not impossible that he just met a Chinese American man who got locked up and was like, I'll lie to this guy. Like, what else am I going to do? Prison's boring, right? He'll believe anything I say. Not a 0% chance. Also, I love the, like, you're a very violent man. no yeah. evidence that G. Gordon Liddy successfully did violence on anyone in his entire life.
Yeah.
Like, not one piece of evidence for this. God, it's so funny.
I can
God,
see
what a,
it.
What a sad thing to say. Yeah. Speaking of sad, you know what isn't sad? The value that our sponsors bring to our listeners' lives. In fact, I don't know, Ian, would you say that our listeners' lives actually have no value whatsoever if they don't purchase the products that sponsor our show?
I think legally I have to say yes.
Yeah, I think you do. Based on the contract you had to sign to get healthcare. Yeah. Anyway, here's ads.
Robert Evans here, and as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, you know, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news, with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts, as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Oh! What a good time. Feeling good. Feeling fine. How's everybody else?
Great. This is great. Amazing.
This is like one of the funniest things I've heard all week. So this is great.
Good stuff. So, after meeting a kung fu master and learning the secrets of the Orient, Liddy wound up back on the East Coast. He was briefly released due to, like, there's some court motions. I think this is evidence that Peter Marulis is a pretty good lawyer. He basically gets him a few weeks out of prison to, like, be with his family based on a technicality. And, like, they know out, this isn't going to last. Shit like this is the kind of stuff a really good lawyer can do for you, right?
Right. Spring break from prison.
Yeah, you get a little spring break from prison.
Holy
then
shit.
He goes back in and he serves another 2 years. He does 52 months in total. On April 12th, 1977, President Jimmy Carter, history's greatest monster, commutes his sentence from 20 years to 8, quote, in the interests of justice. Now, this is one of those moves that I never understood, right? When my knowledge of Woody and Watergate was a little more casual, I was like, what the fuck was Carter? Why would he do that? Like, he's not an idiot. Why would he pardon this very unbelievably guilty man? Hey guys, Robert here. I misspeak. The sentence was commuted, as I noted just a second ago. I used the word pardon here. That's incorrect. A commutation basically means that you're not questioning whether or not they were guilty. They're still guilty. They're just out of incarceration or whatever. This is significant in part because Liddy was not legally able to own firearms for the rest of his life, although he still kept owning guns. He just said they belonged to his wife. He shouldn't have been able to, like, use them, but people don't come after conservatives who get in trouble or hold them to any of the standards of their bail or whatever. But Carter, that always surprised me, right? Why Jimmy Carter? Why would he get this guy out of there? The White House spokesman said that the decision was made, quote, based on a comparison of Mr. Liddy's sentence with all of those others convicted in Watergate prosecutions. In other words, I think it was Carter's personal sense of fairness. I believe this is a bad call, but I get where he's coming from, right? Liddy, despite being an unrepentant fascist, is the most respectable of the White House people who go away. because he doesn't lie or obfuscate, he's like, yeah, I'm guilty. Put me away. I will say nothing else. I'm not going to roll on anybody. And the fact that all of these guys who I think are kind of worse in a lot of ways, you know, Dean is pretty consistent after Watergate of speaking out against the extremism for up to the present day. Right. He's a major figure of sort of being anti the modern Republican Party. I think he might actually have eventually had kind of a real change due to his conscience. Possibly. I'm not certain of that. But all these other guys, Ehrlichman and Magruder and fucking E. Howard Hunt, these people are fucking trash. Haldeman. And the fact that Liddy does more time than them, I think it may have just kind of frustrated Carter because he was aware of that. And so he weirdly thought it was unfair for Liddy to stay in. I don't think that's a good call, but I think that's, from everything I've read, I think that's why Carter made it.
It's the rest of the justice system is so fucked that those people didn't go away for longer.
Yeah. I still think Carter perfectly fine to be critical of him for this choice, but I think that's why it was made. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Liddy gets paroled and his wife picks him up from jail. He had had plenty of time to think while in prison. And I think he had developed a pretty nuanced understanding that his future was in media. He's watching TV and stuff. He's getting letters from his family. All of these other Watergate guys are putting out books that are often bestsellers. So he's aware, number one, probably I need to write a book about this. There's probably a lot of money in that. And number two, I can't work for a campaign anymore. I certainly can't be a lawyer anymore, but I can parlay my fame and my fame, particularly for being this like hard-headed, unbreakable soldier of the far right, into a career. He understands as long as I stay consistent, this can keep me fed forever, right? And, you know, he is very famous. There's a crowd that gathers at the prison on the day of his release. And when he does like a press conference, when his wife picks him up and reporters hurl questions at him, everyone wants to know where he's headed. Liddy gives a cryptic answer to that one. He says, east of the sun and west of the moon. Now, anytime he says anything that he clearly didn't write, I'm like, got to know if that's some Nazi shit. It is not. This comes from a Norwegian folktale. I went ahead and read it just to be like, is there any like racist stuff in there? Not that I saw. It seems to be an adaptation of an older Greek myth. One of the things I learned looking into this is that researchers, scientists or whatever, who study folktales, I guess anthropologists, have a classification system where they like group different kinds of folktales by their type. And this one qualifies as type ATU-425A, the search for the lost husband or the animal as bridegroom. The gist of it's a little bit of a Beauty and the Beast kind of story. The gist of it is that there's this white bear that like comes to a poor family and is like, if you give me your daughter's hand in marriage, I'll make you rich. The bear is secretly like a cursed prince, right? and when she finds out, he's like, look, if you don't follow these very specific rules, I'll be sent to live with an evil witch. And she lives east of the sun and west of the moon. Anyway, that's where the line comes from. Mm-hmm. Nothing Nazi that I found in it. But
it feels like given the way his brain works, that was supposed to be some kind of code to the true someone's, and it just will never know. Whatever the fuck his train of thought was, impossible to know.
He doesn't give a good explanation as to why he picked that one to reference. It is a pretty good cryptic sounding thing to say. I'll give him that. The other question he gets asked is how it feels to be out of prison. And Liddy replies, in German, what does not kill me makes me stronger. And it is true that like Hitler, Liddy seems to mostly have benefited from his time behind bars. This seems to work out a lot of times for fascists, especially when you cut their sentence in half and don't just really put the screws to the fuckers. Maybe a lesson for other folks. The Washington Post sat down with his family right around then, and they published an article that gives us some fascinating glimpses of their lives while Gordon was away. Quote, at the house in Oxon Hill, the color television was on yesterday, and a sound tape recorder was nearby so the boys could capture any reports concerning their father's release. Two dogs relaxed on the living room couch. Outside, the family's 15 or 20 cats minded their own business. Just had to tell you that last bit there. The Liddy's have 15 to 20 cats.
That's too many cats.
I love cats. That's too many cats.
That's so bizarre.
That's a crazy amount of cats.
Yeah.
Anyway, good to know, though. Interesting color on the family here. Yeah. So This piece reveals that the Liddys had purchased copies of every other Watergate memoir they could get their hands on. I think this is so that they can help their dad when he has to write his own memoir. And I'll give him credit. I've read a number of Watergate memoirs. His is the best. Not in terms of its accuracy. None of them are trustworthy. But it's the most readable. You can't put it down. He is actually, this is one of the things he is actually good at. One of the only things that he's legitimately a skill with. He's a pretty good writer. Like he's effective. He's not like an artistic writer. He's not fucking, you know, Cormac McCarthy or whatever. But he's extremely effective. He's very clear. He understands how to pace things. You're never bored. You know, I read the whole book through cover to cover, and I was at a pretty consistent level of interest the whole time. Partly because it's so crazy, but he doesn't get in his own way, right, with his prose. So I'll give him credit for that. He's not a bad writer. The most interesting thing that Washington Post piece gives us as a snapshot is an understanding of how deep the Liddy family's Nixon derangement went. Quote, Jim and Tom Liddy said they had watched the end of the first episode of Washington Behind Closed Doors. They said they are not angry at Nixon for referring in the Frost interview to those involved in the Watergate operation as nuts. I don't blame him for anything. He's gone through so much, said Tom. Poor Dick Nixon, the real victim of Watergate.
Oh, just the ultimate fascist simp.
These people, yeah, it is remarkable. I didn't know people could be that fascist, but by God. Now, the most important thing you get here is an understanding of what a nightmare this whole period behind bars is for Mrs. Liddy. In addition to being the breadwinner, she has to raise their adolescent children alone. Quote, their mother, Tom Liddy said, is having it harder than we are, holding the place financially together, Jim said, finishing his brother's sentence. There were ups and downs, but she went through all of them. And the dimensions of the Liddy marriage have always been kind of confusing to me. They are together for 54 years. I have heard speculation that he cheated on her at one or more points. It's common enough that I think there might be something to it, but I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence of it either. Certainly nothing that's like conclusive. Some of what he writes about her does seem to me to be borderline abusive. The clearest example of that comes right after his release, when she picks him up from prison. Liddy saw what he claims as she's driving away from the prison. He sees four cream-colored Ford Granadas with New York license plates that identify them as press cars that start following him, tracking him as they're leaving the jail. Now, I looked into it. New York does issue special marked plates for journalists. You know, you have to be with a pretty big outlet to get them, but that is a thing that they do. Liddy claims that he had Fran drive slowly at first so they could all get a shot of him, and he hoped they would leave, but they keep following him. Fran tries to lose them, but Liddy writes, quote, she's just not cut out for that sort of thing. So Liddy, the man, has to take charge and save them from these journalist cars that are tracking them, because obviously he's got the FBI. We're going to talk in part two about his FBI driving skills, because we get a chance to test him when he's on Fear Factor, as a spoiler for where this whole episode ends. Yeah, that's right. We come to a Joe Rogan point at the end here, handing off the fat. But anyway, so yeah. Liddy the man has to take charge. Pull over. What? You heard me. Pull over. We're putting in the first team. But you're not even insured. Don't argue with me, goddammit. Pull over.
God.
So he takes over behind the wheel, but he can't lose the tail, right? It doesn't matter that he's taken over because he's no better at this than her. Yeah. And an honest observer might conclude from this that, like, maybe you don't actually know anything about losing a tail, G. Gordon Liddy. Maybe you have absolutely no skills driving in this manner. But he can't admit this. And he writes that he told his wife, I know they've got more cylinders and radios, but nobody stays with me when I don't want him to. There's something wrong here. I don't know. Oh, I guess they do, G. Gordon. His solution to this problem is to drive like even more of a maniac. He like does a 180 in the middle of like a busy street and like spins around and shit. This terrifies his wife. She has spent close to half a decade dealing with all of this unimaginable stress on his behalf. She picks him up, probably not entirely certain how the man that she married is going to be different after almost five years of prison. And then he immediately goes insane on the highway, shouting about imaginary people following them.
I mean, quote, to her comfort, it's nice that he hasn't changed in prison.
I guess, maybe. Quote, it was a challenge I couldn't resist, and I took off, hitting over 70 miles per hour through city streets, going through red lights deliberately and taking turns at the limit of adhesion. By the time I got into Jersey, there were only two tails left, and Fran, scared at her wits, was crying uncontrollably.
Oh my God.
So his wife is just sobbing and he's like, no, I did a good job. Only two guys are still following us.
Yeah. Two out of four. Yeah. You know that radios and telephones exist.
You are still being tailed, G. Gordon Liddy.
Oh my God.
Liddy eventually claims he lost the tail. I don't think he really, I don't believe that at all. Maybe they lived in Jersey and were glad, like,
yeah.
After an extremely long journey, which he says that his, basically him failing to lose this tail and traumatizing his wife is a victory, a symbolic victory of his triumph over Judge Sirica, quote, and his allies in the press. And I love that he sees it that way because it's like, man, the New York Times argued you should be released. The press are your only real friends.
Yeah.
Like, Nixon threw you under the bus. The media held you up because they wanted to, like, make money writing stories about you. Your whole career came from the fact that the press were your allies. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah. Although that's classic. I mean, that playbook gets repeated so much more in the people who he influenced. Yeah.
Liddy is so overjoyed at his victory over this tale that he starts singing the lyrics from his favorite song, which comes from the play. Now, this comes from, I expected him to like sing, I don't know, My Country Tis of Thee. He picks a song from the musical Cabaret, which he had, and it's a song that he modified, quote, to suit myself. The lyrics go, America, America, show us the sign your children have waited to see. The morning will come when the world is thine. Tomorrow belongs to thee. Now, that could be kind of innocuous, right? But when I saw that line, especially the part about how he had reworked the lyrics of this song to suit himself, I had to look into it a little deeper. The song he was singing that he had modified is called Tomorrow Belongs to Me, which could be fashy. And in fact is, because it's from a 1966, Cabaret is a 1966 musical. And it's written by two Jewish musicians, right? Who are lampooning at the fascist qualities that they see in American nationalism. The specific song Tomorrow Belongs to Me is sung by a Nazi in the play. It is specifically a Nazi song about his view of patriotism that Liddy has modified and is kind of like, unironically singing because he is such a fucking fascist. Yeah. And in fact, he's not the only one to do this. Nazis love, this is an example of like kind of failed satire because Nazis love the song Tomorrow Belongs to Me. They love it so much that they have been adapting it for their own albums and pre-printing lines from it in their propaganda since the 1970s. The first use of the song by a white power band that we have documentation of was the year before Liddy published his autobiography, Will, 1979, when British Nazi band Screwdriver does a cover of it. Screwdriver are like hardcore fucking fascist musicians. Yeah. Swedish Nazi singer Saga also records a cover of this song, which is cited by Norwegian mass shooter Anders Breivik as one of the things that inspired him to gun down like 70 children. Love that G. Gordon Liddy singing this.
I mean, so unsurprising, but yeah.
Very, very. This might be the most direct Nazi thing that I've seen him do, right?
And that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty, and that he's done a lot. Liddy claims at the end that after belting out this fascist anthem, his wife looks over at him with tears in her eyes and says, God, after all these years, you haven't changed at all. She blew her nose lustily, then sighed. I don't suppose you ever will. I grinned over at her. Bet your ass, kid. Oh my God.
How does someone blow their nose lustily? That's
a great question, Ian. I don't think they do, but maybe snot perverts, right? Those have to be a thing.
I mean, there's at least one.
Yeah. There's got to be. There has to be a thriving online snot pervert community.
There's definitely a subreddit
that,
for
like,
that.
That has a larger GDP than Liechtenstein, right? The number of the amount of money and snot pervert stuff, you could start your own city outside of Silicon Valley. that's where we're going to close things out for today, because this is basically where his book ends. Don't worry, we have a lot more to say about G. Gordon Liddy, but this is kind of the endpoint of his autobiography, Will. So, Andrew, you got anything to plug? Yeah.
Yeah, since the last episode, we triumphed over the fucking AMPTP asterisk,
you sort of. Beat their asses.
Yeah. Better than anyone ever thought. Labor fucking works.
Yeah.
Strike is over. I don't know. I'm not going back to a writer's room, so I'm back to just the hustle. But I don't know. Still Yo's this racist. Still got premium shows. We did a little strike wrap-up that I think people found informative. So I don't know. Check it out.
Yeah. Hire Andrew. Put him in a room. I know David S. Goyer always listens to the podcast. So, you know, bring him on.
Well, we still got, you know, if we can just get someone to see the vision of Super Soaker full of piss, there's two options. A lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, a lot of irons in the fire. I'm pushing Goyer specifically because it's my dream that you'll get staffed on Foundation, and then I can parlay that into having lunch with Lee Pace, which is my life goal.
Listen, well, yeah, that my promise to you, I guess we'll do that.
Yeah, there we go. Just some In-N-Out burger. Doesn't have to be anything fancy, you know. It can be fancy, Lee, if you want it to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, up to you. This has been Behind the Bastards. If you want to listen to this show and all of our other shows free of ads, Cool Zone. What do we?
Cooler Zone.
Cooler Zone. Thank you, Ian. Cooler Zone Media. Subscribe. It's not very much money and there's no ads. So if you're doing a road trip, if you have like a 9-hour drive and you're like, you know, it'll get me and my family through this 9-hour drive is learning a disastrous amount about G. Gordon Liddy. You can do that without ads, you know?
Yeah, anyway, it's 50% cooler. So
it's 50% cooler. All right, everybody, go to hell. I love you.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.